Major Aikman, Real 5. We were talking about your time when you'd taken over to the old Pier battery, which was B battery, which was later on 268 battery of the regiment. What I wondered, if you could just give us an idea of what the various personalities were like, the key personalities within the battery and, of course, the regiment, because you all messed together, as I believe you said off the tape. Could you take us through some of the key people and give us little pen pictures, pen portraits of them?
When I joined the Durham Heavy Brigade, it was still in the shape of the pre-war organisation. The colonel, whom I never met, had died in his motor car 3 days before I arrived. There was a number of regular staff who had been involved in the Durham Heavy Brigade, the adjutant and a training major. Todd, who was the battery commander of the Huff battery, became the commanding officer of the new 511 Coast Regiment, which was one of the two regiments formed out of the Durham Heavy Brigade, the other being 526 South Gare on the other side of the Tees. Todd...
know his first name? Sir?
Walter Todd.
What was he like?
Walter Todd was a dry, clever solicitor by trade and had been with the regiment for quite some time, I guess. His father was the headmaster of the grammar school in Hartlepool, but I never knew him. I met his sister once when she came to attend a dance that Todd organised in Hartlepool with the Royal Artillery Band, and she subsequently became... No, let's drop that. She subsequently went to Salisbury to the theological college there. However, Todd, he was an able and intelligent, and he was not a warm, likeable person, and there were those who found him difficult. I found him very easy to deal with, and indeed I owe two things to him. The one, when I was nearing my 21st birthday, which was the 2nd of August, 1940. I asked for 48 hours leave, and he said, was there a special reason? And I said, yes, I was wanting to celebrate my 21st birthday with my parents. And he was a little taken aback and said, but I have recommended you for captain. So I thanked him for that. So that was the first thing I think I must thank him for. And the second was... as I was serving in command of the 6-inch battery at Hartlepool, he nominated and recommended that I should go on the 9th War Gunnery course, and I became an instructor in gunnery. By becoming an instructor in gunnery, ensured that I stayed with the Coast Artillery, because I was now so highly qualified in Coast Artillery there was no question of returning me to the field army.
We'll come to that, because that's a little later on. So he was one. A good officer, then?
A good officer, yes. A spiky person. Not widely liked, but able and competent and efficient.
Now, any other... Who are the other senior officers?
He was the senior officer. The others were... there was a bank manager, Hornsby. Col, his nickname was...
Col Hornsby. A major?
No, a captain. Walter Todd was the only major that was in the Yuff end, of the Hartlepool end of the Heavy Brigade. I don't remember too much about him. He busied himself with administrative matters, and he didn't tread much on my... There was a younger subaltern who was posted... shortly after I arrived to the hut to Tobruk, the Coast Battery in North Africa, and he thought that it would be a good idea if I went, since I had no family connection and he had a wife and child in Hartlepool. But I didn't support him, because I knew virtually nothing about Coast Artillery at that stage.
You mentioned him.
and I was reading hard the textbooks to try and find out what it was all about, and I was glad of the course that I was sent on.
So the other personalities, who else?
Personalities. Other personalities. I've lost his name, but there was a regular major who had been part of the training unit, training aspect of the Durham Heavy Brigade, and I remember him, but I can't remember his name. A pleasant, likeable man, who I suppose probably had quite a bit to do with the promotion of this young subaltern from the BEF into command of a battery. I was the youngest person in the unit, but then throughout all my wartime service, only once was there an officer younger in years than I, so that was not unusual. When the battery was formed, there was a newly commissioned subaltern, obviously junior in status, but I suppose 15 years older than I. He had a wife and two children. She came to live in Hartlepool, and I remember being warned by Walter Todd about allowing my junior officer to become a heavy married subaltern, spending his time with his wife and not with the unit. The married colleague of mine, Leslie Nunn, I maintain contact with until after the war, and indeed after the war, when I had returned to Oxford, I went to see him and he showed me around Lloyd's of London, which had not yet moved to the Rogers premises, and I saw the Lutine Bell. Who else in the regiment?
Senior NCOs or warrant officers?
The warrant officer that I was closest to was one of Walter's long connections, a man called Ord.
Ord, with an E?
O-R-D, Battery Sergeant Major Ord. He always made it clear to me that he was happy to be a Battery Sergeant Major at Hartlepool, and if he were ever posted away, he would work his ticket. And in due course, after I had left Hartlepool, he did. Which I brought with me from the 1st Heavy Regiment a Sergeant Major and several soldiers, including my batman, and they settled into the Old Pier Battery. Old Pier Battery was also made up of a number of young men from Sussex. They were too young to serve in a wartime infantry regiment, and as infantry immatures, they were posted into the artillery, and so we had, I suppose, 8 or 10 men. There were two brothers, Mitchell, the man Slocum, who were young from Sussex, and they formed part of the strand of the B Battery, or 268 as it was renamed. Later in 1940, the army decided that they would rotate all the batteries in Orkney, and a battery from Orkney came down to take the place of B Battery. Todd saw to it that I was retained in Hartlepool, and a completely new set of people came to Old Pier, and at that stage I lost connection with my people from the 1st Heavy Regiment because they went to Orkney.
Can I ask you what your batman did for you, the officer's servant? Can you just, you know, because it's always an interesting relationship.
The batman was wished upon me when I first joined the Heavy Regiment. In Plymouth, the soldiery and the headquarters and so forth was in the Royal Citadel at Plymouth. The local authority had a bylaw to ensure that the guns could not be taken over the Lyra Bridge, which meant that the guns which were kept at Fort Samford on the other side of the main of the bridge could not come into Plymouth. And we also, at that kept our guns, and we also kept our horses. And my batman was one of the men. He was an Irishman from Ulster. He was very good at horses, I believe. I knew very little about horses, and so apart from looking after my affairs and working in the mess, I had no particular close association with Harrison.
What about when he came with you to Hartlepool?
Well, in Hartlepool, he again, he worked in the mess as a waiter. I don't...
What did he actually do for you, though?
Well, before the war, he saw that my buttons were clean and that the uniform was presentable, and looked after my boots and made my bed. I don't remember much else than that. It was the kind of things, or in a way, that I had had the college servant at Oxford do, looking after my affairs and kit. No particular. There was.
Did he do that for you as well at Hartlepool?
I don't remember. I don't remember. Probably. Maybe not. I don't know.
Now, what was a typical before the this first battery? You know, before the battery changed. What would a typical day be like for you? You know, how would a day pan out? I know there's no such thing as a typical day in some ways, but
There is the schedule of work to be done, and therefore there are the myself and Leslie Nunn would have to share between ourselves, ensuring that there was someone on duty at the old pier. And we had to see to it that the men carried through a series of training and manning to make sure that the guns were always at the state of readiness required, which I think would probably be 5 minutes or something of that sort. And they were manned at night, so that they were at 30 seconds notice at night.
What sort of training exercises would they be carrying out during the day?
Well, there wouldn't be any training exercises done away from the unit. All the training was done on the gun in the battery. We had, in addition to the two 12-pounder anti-motor torpedo boat 12-pounder guns, we also mounted an anti-aircraft machine gun. Can't remember, could it have been an old-fashioned Lewis gun, or am I recalling earlier stage? It was, certainly it was, it might well have been an anti-aircraft Lewis gun, or it might have been a Bren gun on the pier. I can remember Walter once complaining to me that the Bren gun had not fired when some German aircraft had been in the vicinity. And I replied that I thought perhaps it was no bad thing. We didn't particularly wish to draw the attention of German aeroplanes to military activity on the pier, but that was not my doing. It was the way it had happened. We saw quite a number of German aircraft from time to time in the Hartlepool area, and of course there were a lot of air raids. The air raids were very, very noisy. The targets were essentially Middlesbrough. There was barrage balloons would fly over Middlesbrough. I remember once when the electric storm was about, seeing barrage balloon after barrage balloon after barrage balloon struck by lightning and set on fire, which was quite a dramatic sight.
Did they ever raid Hartlepool, or was it really Middlesbrough?
Yes, well, Hartlepool was not the target. It was West Hartlepool and Middlesbrough where the target was. The only soldiers that we lost were some of the sappers from the Searchlight Company, Royal Engineers, who were on leave in Middlesbrough, were killed. But we had aeroplanes. I remember a JU-88 flying very close to the lighthouse in the battery area, and I can recall complaining bitterly to the soldiers of the anti-aircraft machine gun for not engaging. but they had not recognised what it was. It was near enough for me to see the pilot in the plane. Part of the air raid scene, too, there was a Norwegian warship. It was an anti-aircraft warship, and it was anchored in the bay. And so whenever there was any air activity about, there was always a great deal of noise and from that ship, until one day the Germans decided to get rid of it, and the object of their attack was obviously to destroy the ship, which they did. Until then, the sight of Norwegian Marines in the streets of Hartlepool had been a common sight. The other sight that was very frequent, of course, was the Royal Navy inshore minesweeping activities. There were three or four minesweepers would go out from Hartlepool, and as the battery on the old pier, we were very comfortable and familiar with the sight of these ships going out. I can remember one morning seeing one of these minesweepers, and she touched a mine just off the 6-inch lighthouse battery, and there was the tremendous explosion of the mine. You saw the ship disappear in the cloud of spray, and when the spray cleared, there was no sign of anything at all. There was an occasion when I was invited and took a trip with one of the minesweepers, and we sailed down the Yorkshire coast and looked at the they were electric minesweepers. They had engines which produced surges of electric current, the purpose being to detonate the mines by stimulating the electrical performance, magnetic effect of a ship, and they had the regular patrols to do this as they sailed along the shipping line. And there was a frequent sight of the inshore convoys that were carrying things up and down the coasts of Britain at that time, and you would see those ships. Some of them would have perhaps a barrage balloon attached, but more usually they were protected by their own anti-aircraft machine guns, I suppose. One of my sad memories is of a Christmas day and watching German aeroplanes attacking one of these coastal convoys, no doubt doing it on Christmas Day, believing that everyone would be relaxed and there would be no opposition for them. The RAF fighters to deal with the German raiders were also on site on occasion, but air raids by night was the usual thing, and so there was the searchlights, the anti-aircraft, and I can remember once being in the command post at the Yuff battery when there was a tremendous explosion, which we thought had to be a German aeroplane, but we were told afterwards by the evaluation people that it was in fact a mine that had been hit, as it was being parachuted down into the sea and had been struck by the anti-aircraft missiles.
How would you spend your day? If you see what I mean?
Well, at B Battery, my day would be spent. I lived at the main headquarters, which was at the Hough Battery. Old Pier was a short walk away. After breakfast, I would go down and see what was proceeding and going on. I would look at the engine room and the searchlights and the guns, make sure that everything was in order. The soldiers themselves lived in three houses that had been requisitioned on probably Cliff Terrace. I forget exactly which street is which, but we had three houses requisitioned for the soldiers. I don't remember any spectacular event. As I say, my battery, the one I formed. The other activity I remember particularly was that in order to build up this new unit, I encouraged them to be footballers, and we joined the local Hartlepool League, and most of the other teams, all the other teams, would have been football teams provided by companies. And I can remember an episode once where it was manifest that the referee was determined to do everything in his power to ensure that the Gunners did not win. And one of my soldiers, who was a referee as a hobby, I could see that he was getting more and more and more incensed by this appalling referee. And I can remember having the wit to detail three soldiers to make quite sure that at the end of the game, my soldier referee did not take it out on this appalling civilian referee. And it was as well I had done that.
The one thing is there was no actual need for the true purpose of your battery. There were no German surface attacks or infringements.
The coast artillery in the Tees never had any engagement with the enemy at all. There was, of course, the well-recorded battle in 1914, which was still on everyone's history books, but during the Second War there were no Germans and no engagement. I've talked about the Yuff battery, which was the 6-inch battery, I've talked about the 12-pounder battery on Old Pier. I suppose one of the big things that happened in the Yuff battery in my time was the upgrading of the equipment.
Hang on, we haven't really got you to Yuff battery yet, right. You see. This business of the your battery going to Orkney and you staying behind, that seems to have happened in January 1941. And then you become battery commander of A battery, which I presume is that the Hough battery?
That's right.
And that's 267 battery.
That's 267. And it stayed 267, I think, for the rest of the time.
And that's the 6-inch battery.
It was a 6-inch battery. When they put the 6-inch guns in Hartlepool in 1906, there were two guns called the Hough battery, side by side, and then somewhat to one side there was the Lighthouse battery. In the engagement in 1914, the Lighthouse battery had been blocked by the Lighthouse, which was therefore rebuilt after the 14 war, so as to be behind the line of the guns. And the three guns, the Lighthouse and the two Yuff batteries, were then treated as one command unit, and the one command post controlled all three guns. In my time, the effect of the decision that was taken before the war to upgrade the battery from a close defence role to a counter-bombardment role, and for a counter-bombardment role, the 6-inch Mark 7 guns were replaced by 6-inch Mark 24, and the mountings had had the capability of raising them to a 45 degree, and so we had to build new emplacements for these new guns and new mountings. Right before that, in 1940, in fact, when I was at B Battery, one of the things that had been done to the 6-inch battery was to build walls behind the guns so that they could not be shot at by low-flying aeroplanes. I remember that work being done. And then we installed these new Mark 24 6-inch guns for the high-angle purpose. We proof-mounted these. And
what does that mean?
When you install a new gun, you fire it at zero elevation and you fire it at maximum elevation and you make sure that it performs as it should. Of course, when you're firing it at 45 degree angle, the shell will go about 22,000 yards, and because the battery at Yuff is fairly low sighted, there's no way that you could see 24,000 yards. And I remember a young subaltern being distressed on the proof firing because he had not seen the shell fall on the sea, and being surprised to find that he couldn't have done because he was far too low down. In order to observe the fall of shot, we used the observations on the other side of the T's. Now, I've talked to you about the 511 regiment and the battery at 267, the 6-inch. I've talked about the 12-pounder battery. I've not talked about the Seton Carew battery, which was further along the coast. It was an emergency battery intended to protect that bit of the shore from landing, and that was part of 511 regiment. 526 regiment was on the other side of the T's, was South Gare, and that comprised the 6-inch battery on the Gare Peninsula, G-A-R-E, Gare, South Gare. It also comprised the 9.2 counter-bombardment battery at Pasley, and also the two emergency batteries at Whitby and Scarborough. We had some doings with those units from time to time, but at this stage, when I'm talking about the proofing of the new 6-inch, we were using observation posts on the south side. One of the observation posts I was intrigued to find was the which was left over from the defences at an earlier stage. There had been two 9.2 batteries, one of which was on the north side of the T's, and I saw that for the first time when I travelled by train from Hartlepool to Newcastle, and looking out of the window, I was amazed to see a 9.2-inch battery position, which is now entirely enclosed in a manufacturing unit that was making chemicals of some sort. When there were two 9.2 inches of the counter-bombardment defences of the T's, there were a number of observation points. One was on a high point in a village behind Hartlepool at Hart. Another was in the third floor of a hotel on the Red Car front. And again, you had the extraordinary sight of what was manifestly a coast artillery observation post with the conventional, well, the capability of having the conventional optical instruments in it, as a third floor of this hotel, which had reverted to being a hotel. For the purpose of the proofing of the 6-inch gun, we re-established one of the observation points there, and I remember going with the instructor in gunnery from Northern Command one August bank holiday Monday, and we drove through Middlesbrough, and there was the site of the large railway station in the heart of Middlesbrough as we went. But when we came back, the large railway station had disappeared. It had been destroyed by an air raid while we were down the coast, and I was fearful as to what might have happened to the civilians who were catching trains for a day out on the coast, perhaps. But casualties and air raids were never published, and so I knew not.
Now, could you explain the counter-bombardment role? What does it mean, and why was it different from the previous role?
The defence of a seaport, by the time I was into it, there was the anti-motor torpedo boat defences, where you would look for a gun that fired fast and was directly controlled by the sergeant in charge of the gun. The 12-pounder was the equipment that had been used in the First War. By the Second War, the up-to-date equipment was a 6-pounder twin, but we did not have any of those in Hartlepool. The close defence was the next stage of the defence of the port, and this would be intended to fire at a ship that was of a destroyer type, perhaps, that was coming to, close into the land. The next stage of defence was the anti-block ship, in order to sink any ship that was coming in with the intention of sinking itself and blocking the fairway for the ships coming in and out of the